This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580 and online at WILL.UIUC.edu. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in today. Carl Fleming grew up in a tough white church orphanage in North Carolina in the 1930s and 40s. That, he says, tilted his sympathies forever toward all underdogs. He became a reporter, and in the 1960s, he covered the biggest stories of the civil rights movement. Carl Fleming writes about that time in his memoir, Son of the Rough South, an Uncivil Memoir. The book was published last year. It's now available in paperback. And while Carl Fleming wrote this book, recently he began thinking about his life some years ago after coming close to death. When he was covering rioting in Watts in 1966, he was beaten nearly to death. Recovering in the hospital, there were many requests from the media to see him. He'd become a story. The reporters wanted to know what he thought about the people who had attacked him. Fleming didn't feel any animosity, and he had to admit to himself that was kind of odd. Why did he feel that way? After all, he says, quoting here, "By all genetic and social rights, I should perhaps have been out burning crosses at night." Listeners, I invite you to join the discussion this afternoon. I look forward to your questions and comments for Carl Fleming. You can join us with a telephone call. Here are the numbers. In the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Toll free, 800-222-9455. 800-222-9455. WILL. Carl Fleming worked for four Southern newspapers before going to work for Newsweek in 1960. In 1965, he became Los Angeles bureau chief. After leaving Newsweek, he worked in television, then was editor and publisher of California Business. He is president of Primetime Communications, a media consulting firm. He and his wife, the novelist Ann Taylor Fleming, live in Los Angeles. His book, Son of the Rough South, an Uncivil Memoir, is published by Public Affairs Books. 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Mr. Fleming, it's so good to talk with you.
Well, that was a very nice introduction.
Oh, well, you're very welcome. It was my pleasure to write it. Now, by the time you were on the story in Watts, you had covered many civil rights stories in the South. What were among some of those stories?
Well, I covered Birmingham, where the four little girls were killed by a Ku Klux Klan bomber. I covered Jackson, Mississippi, where Medgar Evers was shot in the back by Byron Dealey Beckwith. I covered the extremely violent rioting that attended the entrance into the University of Mississippi of James Meredith. I covered the assassination of the three kids in Philadelphia,
Mississippi,
and all kinds of violent demonstrations all across the South, from South Carolina, Louisiana, Mississippi, and the Carolinas.
Yeah. So prior to going to Los Angeles, you'd been in many violent, dangerous situations.
Indeed. In fact, I had been shot at in during the night of the Ole Miss thing. I went outside the building where the government had set up a command post, what the local people called the Lyceum, where the National Guard and U.S. Army and the reporters were hanging out. And I stepped outside to take a look at what was going on and had four bullets stitched up alongside my head. And I was threatened many times and beaten and followed and had my phone tapped. But the interesting thing as it relates to my later getting almost killed in the Watts riots was that in the South, the people you had to be afraid of were the white people, because the sheriffs were mostly in league with the Ku Klux Klan, and you had, it was almost like being in behind enemy lines in some foreign country if you were a reporter. And I was especially singled out because I was a Southern guy. I'd grown up in North Carolina in this orphanage. And so I was a traitor to the so-called Southern way of life. These Klan people and sheriffs and rednecks, they could understand these, what they call members of the Northern Jew Communist press coming down because, after all, they didn't know any better. And they were mostly communists anyway, or so they said. But for a Southern guy like me, I should have known better. So me and a few of my Southern colleagues took more of the brunt of their violence and vituperation than the ordinary garden variety reporter might have done.
Yeah. Now, this is something you said that's very interesting in the book. I had lived among and around Negroes all my life, but it was not until I was 34 years old that I had my first man-to-man conversation with a black person, one professional talking to another.
Indeed, because the relations between blacks and whites were distant. Blacks didn't want to talk to whites. If a white person came into a black neighborhood, it could only mean trouble. It was either the police or it was somebody trying to sell them something. Consequently, blacks were extremely guarded around whites. And then they have taught this kind of phony obsequiousness. Whites would have no reason to talk to blacks unless, as I said in my book, the white lady would drive across the tracks in the morning to pick up her maid and drive her over to her house to wash her clothes or cook her food, or the black guy would come and mow your lawn. But there was no true social intercourse on anything that might have resembled equality. It just did not happen. Of course, the South, and not only the South, but most of the country was totally, completely segregated, so that an equal relationship was just completely incomprehensible.
Yeah, yeah. So here you are, a young man, and you're now leaving the South, where you'd been seen by many whites as a traitor to the white race, and you're moving, you and your young family, to Los Angeles, and you have hopes for a calmer life.
Indeed. I was absolutely sick of violence by the time I had left there. I had also covered the assassination of John Kennedy, and I was just absolutely so sick with violence. And covering these stories, and mostly in Mississippi and Alabama and Louisiana, I would literally go back to my hotel or motel room at night and just throw up. I was just totally revulsed by the things I saw whites doing to black, the inhumanity, the cruelty. It was just too much. And so it was with a kind of relief that I got transferred out to Los Angeles in 1965. I thought I got a lot of kidding from my Confederate reporters who told me all I would be covering would be vapid movie stars and crazy little old ladies in tennis shoes and religious nuts. But there was a kind of a relief about it, because I thought I could live a kind of a normal life being a journalist and a reporter and get away from the violence.
Huh.
And then, lo and behold, this riot breaks out, and suddenly, quite unlike in the South, where white people had been the enemy and blacks were the people you took refuge with, suddenly here I was, this white guy, and suddenly I was the enemy. And then on this particular evening, I was just struck down and woke up to hear these angry black voices above me, and clearly they had wanted me dead. In fact, after I got hit over the head, several of them literally tried to stomp me to death. It was, I must say, quite an emotional shock.
Yeah. Well, back up to your arrival in 1965 in Los Angeles. Tell us about the ride-along you did with a guy from the sheriff's department as a part of learning about your new beat.
Well, I thought, hey, Los Angeles is a big, sophisticated city where racism, I mean, I was mature enough to know that racism existed, but I had not expected to find it expressed in the same blatant ways. And I'm riding along with the PR guy from the sheriff's department, and he's taking me around South Central Los Angeles, part of which is incorporated and therefore within the sheriff's domain. And I was just absolutely shocked to hear him use the N-word just as freely as I had in the South. And then I went around to some of the police places, and in the 77th Street precinct station, they had a picture of Eleanor Roosevelt on the wall with the word, well, I don't know if I'm supposed to use this word, nigger lover, printed below it. And the police referred to their clubs as nigger knockers. And I quickly began to learn that the police here, though a bit more sophisticated, were just as repressive and were just as racist as those I had run across in the South, and which is in large reason that produced the anger that caused the city to erupt into this huge riot, which was the granddaddy of all urban riots in America, like more than 30 people killed, millions and millions of dollars of businesses destroyed by fire.
Yeah. What? Tell us a little bit more about, give us some more background, some more history here about, you know, what had ignited the rioting that began August 11th, 1965.
A guy named Marquette Fry was stopped by a highway patrolman in South Central. Again, this being not part of the city of L.A., but still part of the city in real terms, was stopped allegedly for drunk driving, and his mother came out and began arguing with the highway patrolman. And then it just erupted, a crowd formed, somebody started throwing rocks, and it was just like throwing a match into a barrel of dynamite. Just exploded, because the rage had been there for so long. It was just like a tinderbox. It was like throwing a match down in a dry forest. Boom! And this riot went on for 5 days. And there was a tremendous, over 50% unemployment among kids. Joblessness widespread. Complete lack of equal education, job opportunities, split up families. Just a huge degree of hopelessness. And the other thing which I had not realized was what a ghetto it was. Los Angeles is 435 square miles, Los Angeles County. So geographically, the black community of South Central and Watts was this island of segregation cut off by freeways. Nobody ever went there. Nobody white ever went there, unless in the view of the people who did live there, there were merchants who came down and ran their businesses and then went back home to Beverly Hills at night. So there was a tremendous amount of resentment against white exploitation, and in fact, not a little bit of of anti-Semitism was involved in all that. So it was just like a rocket that went off, and then, of course, after that, there was a wave of these urban riots that swept all across America, as I'm sure you well remember, and as our history books record. But it was just a very, very, very angry time. And what? And another interesting thing about it for me was that I had known Martin Luther King quite well and had heard him speak dozens and dozens of times. And he came out of the milieu of the Christian church in the South.
Mm-hmm.
And church in the South was community. It was the one place that whites would allow blacks to congregate and kind of do their thing and have a life. So Southern community life was built around the churches, and the values came from there. And here in L.A., these young blacks could have cared less about the church. They were not connected with it. They were running on the streets with nothing but anger against authority. And, in fact, I heard King came out to try to quell the trouble. And King was in this meeting hall with a big crowd of black people, and he said, "We need love." And some black guy standing behind me said, "We don't need no goddamn love. We need jobs." So there was a complete refutation of the values that he brought. They were not related in any way to the church, couldn't care about it. And And in fact, that was what was expressed in this entire wave of riots that, as I said, swept across urban America at that time. And of course, later on, you remember from your history books, he went to Chicago and didn't do very well there either for the same reasons.
Yeah, yeah. Well, the mid-60s to the late-60s, new voices and a new message were coming to the fore. Stokely Carmichael, Malcolm X, the Black Panthers.
Indeed.
Did you speak with King about that in the mid to late 60s?
I did speak to him about it at some length. And I also spoke a lot to Stokely Carmichael, who I knew quite well. In fact, if you don't mind taking the time for this little anecdote, the day I got killed, this was another riot that followed. The day I almost got killed, this was another riot that followed about 8 months later after the big one, when a black guy, was killed by a cop while driving his pregnant wife to the hospital to have a baby. Big riot blew up. And Stokely Carmichael, who was the father of the term Black Power and had formed that in Mississippi, when we were all down there in Greenwood and other such places, he said to this audience, I was standing at the back of this all-black crowd, and he said, "And these white reporters come down here exploiting us, and they never write anything about us except it makes us look bad, and all they write about is the things we allegedly do. They don't write about the police's justice, and I want you to go down to City Hall and march down there and tell them to turn this cop over to them, or we're going to do this, we're going to do that. And these reporters that come down here, we ought to be charging them money to come down here to talk to us." And these black people turned around and looked at me, and I was really put on notice. And, of course, later that evening was when, in fact, I got bonked on the head and beat up and almost killed. But anyway, Carmichael and Malcolm X were preaching a different tune, and the Black Panthers. And that tune was, "If we are attacked, we will respond. We will get guns." And in fact, the night that Martin Luther King was killed, I was in Washington and covered the riot that broke out there. And Stokely Carmichael had his gun on him and was waving it in front of black crowds and urging them to go get their guns. So they weren't, that generation of people, we're not having any of the pacifist, turn the other cheek, Christian message that Martin Luther King espoused at all.
Yeah.
It was a different, very, very different world.
Yeah. At the same time, let's go back to when you're in the hospital room recovering from this beating that you took in May 66, and suddenly you're a story. A white reporter being attacked, big news.
Big news, and it did not escape my attention, of course, that there had been black-on-black violence in Watts forever, and white-on-black violence forever. Made no news. Nobody lifted an eyebrow. The Los Angeles Times did not have one single black reporter. So I was kind of offended, in fact, that suddenly my room was filled with media people. I had had, I guess, a kind of a reputation as being a reporter who was liberal, at least on the issue of civil rights, because of my background in the South. And so they came to me more or less in the spirit of, "Okay, big liberal reporter, now what do you think, now that these black people have damn near killed you?" And what I said was that, knowing what I knew by then about what it was like to grow up as a black kid on the streets of Los Angeles with the police repression, the lack of education, the lack of opportunity, poor health, no jobs, split homes, alcohol, all that stuff, that had I been one of those kids, I might at least have felt like hitting some white guy on the back of the head myself. I did joke that this incident had made me an even more dedicated believer in the nonviolent philosophy of Martin Luther King, but it was confusing because I knew I should be angry at somebody. I just didn't quite know who. So it was a kind of a moral dilemma, and I still feel that way. I understood the anger, not least because of my early growing up, where I had been in this orphanage, which was a very tough place, and where I had been a minority, where I had been bullied, where I had developed a keen sense of dislike for the misuse of authority and power. So I tended then and still do identify with underdogs.
Yeah.
So my if I did not sympathize with the people or approve of what they had done to me, at least I had an understanding of it. And that was the point I had tried to make, which I would hope would pick on to it. You don't have to agree with what people say, or even your enemies, but if you want to get to solutions to things, you better damn well at least understand where they're coming from.
Mm. Spoken like a reporter.
Like a reporter, right.
Carl Fleming is our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. We're talking with him about his memoir, Son of the Rough South, an Uncivil Memoir. This is the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us today with questions, comments. Join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Let's talk now with a listener calling in today from Chicago on line 4. Hi.
Good morning or good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
I find this very interesting. I'd like to ask your guest two questions, actually. One, is it true that during the when the time the reporters were down there covering stories like the murder of Emmett Till, they were told by people, you should stay close to town at night, you shouldn't wander off, otherwise you might have a problem? That's one. And two, how did the Southerners, the white Southerners, treat black reporters when they came from the North down into the South?
Well, as to question number one, the few reporters who were down there, white reporters, and there were not that many, were extreme. I rode with a good friend for self-protection from the New York Times, a guy named Claude Sitton. We always shared automobiles. We stayed in adjoining rooms in motels. We made certain that our rooms were on the front of the motel, near the manager's office, in a well-lighted place. We did not use the motel telephones. We used payphones. We did not drive out into the country alone at night at all. We made damn sure we obeyed all traffic laws. We made sure we didn't drink too much. You just had to watch your step, because you never knew where somebody could kick your door in and drag you out. In fact, in Greenwood, Mississippi, one night, we had gone to bed in our adjoining rooms, as usual, exhausted and having had a few drinks, and went to sleep. And about 2 a.m., there came this terrible pounding on my door. And my friend Claude Sitton came flying through the adjoining room and said, "Don't open the door." And I said, "Are you crazy? I'm not about to open the door." And this pounding kept continuing, and it was a female voice. "Let me in, let me in, let me in." I climbed up on a table and looked out the windows, which were up near the roof, these slit windows up near the ceiling, and looked down, and there was a black woman pounding on the door. And Claude and I had exactly the same thought at the same time, that this woman had been sent there to set us up, and had we opened the door and let us in, we would immediately have been arrested or killed and on a charge that we had raped this woman. We were also very careful. We had been urged by many people, carry a gun. And we both knew, I knew certainly, it would have been absolutely suicide to carry a gun. You just had to be very, very, very careful. Never ate in a restaurant with your back to the door. All kinds of things now that seem completely silly, of course. But then you just had to be, as my friend Claude said, prudent, Carl, prudent. And as to the black reporters, they simply were not present. They were present at some of the big-time places where, like the Emmett Till trial, like Birmingham, but most of the time they did not even appear because it would just been absolutely too dangerous. And they came to the official events, the little press conferences that anybody would have. They would go to the mass meetings in the churches, but then they would have to disappear someplace at night back into the black community.
I would imagine the Southerners would resent an educated African-American from the North.
Oh, absolutely. One of the famous segregationists from Mississippi, in fact, once said that to educate a nigger is just to ruin a good cotton picker. And that kind of attitude prevailed. You know, they used the term uppity all the time. And it was really a fear. More than anything else, it was a sexual fear. There was a profound sexual fear of the supposed superior black masculinity and sexual appear. And most of this violence came from a fear of the black male for that reason.
I would imagine they would really, really go off the edge if they saw a black reporter or a black worker walking with a white person. They would just go bananas over that, I would imagine.
Go bananas, you would have been killed, or at the very least beaten up. There's just no question about it. I remember once in Jackson, Mississippi, there was a black reporter there who I had gotten to know, a guy from Jet Magazine, and I ran some risk, in fact, in sharing my motel room with him. We came in late, and he got out early, so nobody would see him, but that was not a prudent thing to do. Probably wouldn't have done it had I not had a few drinks at Jack Daniels.
Well, I find this very interesting. You know, I heard back in the 30s, whenever Joe Louis would win a fight, and the blacks would listen to it on the radio, that they would arrange for them to stay at the house because after he would win, the KKK would go on a rampage down there. I don't know if that was true or not, but that's what I heard.
Well, I never heard that, but certainly blacks were supposed to be subservient and stay what was called, quote, in their place, unquote.
So how do the Southern, how is it different today?
Well, that's an interesting question, and I have gone back quite a lot, including on a recent book tour. And I think the most important thing is the fear is gone. The fear is gone. Black people now no longer have to walk down the street thinking or knowing that if they look crossways at some guy, or especially some woman, that the Klan is going to come at night and drag them out and kill them. So that kind of fear is gone. Martin Luther King often said that when the dust settles in the civil rights movement, the South would be the best place in the country for blacks and whites to get along together. My observation is that that is entirely true. I have been back quite a bit in recent months, and I see more true integration in the South than in any place in the country.
Well, maybe they had to go through that spasm, maybe other parts.
You go through a barbecue joint in Memphis, Tennessee, the maitre d' is black. You go to the to your hotel, the concierge is black. The waiters are black. Half the clientele is black. People work together, eat together, get along just fine. And it's because of the closeness of the land and the soil in the South. Los Angeles remains the largest black segregated ghetto in the United States. So I think the true integration has not taken place as much or in the rest of the country as it has in the South. Now,
well, I guess one Southern politician was right when he said, in some ways Northerners were hypocrites because when some place was restricted, you know what that meant.
Absolutely. No Jews and no blacks.
I want to thank the listener for his call this afternoon, for his questions, and invite others to join us this afternoon. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455, 333-WILL, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. I think one of the things that I would like to talk with you a little bit about before we run out of time, and that is your life in the orphanage. I think you began to feel for the underdog before you ever went to the orphanage, but there life was pretty tough for the kids, for the boys in particular. And you know, the orphanage was all white, and before that your life had been also, you know, very much, you were very much part of the white part, the white face of the South. But yet in the orphanage you began to read things like Twain and Dickens.
True.
And I think this had a very important, this was very important for you and for your formation and how you avoided, you know, being out there burning crosses at night.
Well, I, by all rights, I should have been burning crosses because that was the atmosphere in which I grew up. Whites were whites and blacks were whites, and never the twain should meet on equal terms. But I was a shy and sensitive kid, and I think something else had happened to me before I went to the orphanage, and that was that my father died when I was 5 months old, and my mother struggled along to take care of us without much without much success. And I was really kind of a mama's boy, to tell the truth. And one day I was out playing. This was when I was about four or five years old. And I was surrounded by this bunch of older kids and forced to perform a sexual act. And then they laughed at me. They laughed at me. And I went back to our little apartment and went in the bathroom crying. And my mother knocked on the door and said, "What's wrong, son?" And I said, "Nothing." And I did not share that secret until I was 60 years old. It was just too shameful. But I think right then it began my hatred of bullying, the misuse of power. And then I got into this orphanage, which is which was a place, as I said, that was extremely tough. You had to learn to defend yourself in order to survive. There was no parental contact. The matrons of these cottages did not have time or, in some cases, any inclination for physical or emotional affection. So I had to learn to be a tough guy. And I did learn to be a tough guy.
Yeah, you weren't an angel either.
Well, you if you didn't get tough, you didn't survive. And so I learned to do all the stuff, you know, to use the profane language. I learned to fight, which I didn't like to do at all, but I learned to do it. And by the time I had gotten with Newsweek, I was 210 pounds, crew cut, hard drinking, hard smoking, caustic, cynical, profane, and don't mess with me unless you want to get knocked down. That, of course, is not who I truly was, but that's who, that was the facade I put up to cover the shame from that childhood incident and from the shame of the orphanage and poverty and the fear that somehow I was not really a man.
We've got a caller waiting for us. I want to get to this individual very quickly here, but I do want to go back to the idea of reading Twain and Dickens, because here I think, you know, your sympathies now, you can identify with the underdogs in these stories. You can,
I did.
The cruelties of race and class.
I took refuge in the orphanage library. It had 3,000 books, and I think I read every one of them. But I was especially touched by Mark Twain and Dickens and Stephen Crane, Badge of Red Courage, Jack London, and Sinclair Lewis, and all those writers of the early 20th century. All of those who defended the underdogs became my heroes. And the journalists that I began to read, H.L. Mencken, Lincoln Steffens, people like that, all of those were people who tilted against Ambrose Bierce. All those people, Ida Tarbell, who was the first big woman, famous journalist who went after powerful corruption. All those people became my heroes and my role models, and that's who I wanted to become when I got a job in the newspaper business and began to realize that I had not a job but a calling, that I could, too, stand up for justice and tell stories. And I don't mean to say that I was prejudiced in my work. I took great pride, as I think all journalists did, and being objective and honest, and above all, being fair.
Let's talk with another listener. Caller in Normal on line one. Hi.
Hello. I was wondering if I could ask your guest just for his perspective on my experience. I'm from the North, and I'm white, and I found myself in Montgomery, Alabama in October of 2005, and around the time that Rosa Parks died and was brought to Montgomery to be honored. And a group of us who were also white and Asian and were just so honored that we could go to her visitation and be part of that event and that history. And when we were there, we were the only white people at this visitation, which was, you know, quite crowded and it had a long line. And after we went in and paid our respects, came out, an African-American reporter approached us to ask for our you know, feelings. So I was really kind of disturbed that there weren't more white people there. Of course, that was only at the time that we were there. They may have been white people at other times. But I was really concerned that perhaps, you know, things weren't as good as perhaps we thought they were. I was just wondering if your guest could give his perspective on that.
Racial heaven has not yet been achieved by any means.
Right.
Martin Luther King once said, the law can't make people love me, but the law can keep them from lynching me. And I think what's most important is what I said at the beginning when Celeste asked me that question. The big change is the fear is gone.
Yes.
The fear is gone. The Ku Klux Klan, the Citizens Council, these redneck sheriffs, and these other racists do not have license anymore to kill, beat, intimidate black people. I cannot express how profound a change that is, because in the 60s and then on into the 70s, these people were actually licensed by the power structure, the political power structure, the business community, the press, even the religious community, more or less gave permission and license to these racists to do violence on black people. That has completely changed. There is equality, more or less, in hiring. There are more black elected officials in the state of Mississippi today than there are in any place in the United States. Does that mean that all racism has gone and that white people have changed in their hearts? Not by any means. Racism will always exist. But what creates such a terrible thing is when people like that have a license to carry out their racism and do cruel and murderous things on somebody else. And that's the big change.
Yes, and I agree with you that is a tremendous change, but it just disturbed me. I would think that intellectually and emotionally that there would have been some people in Montgomery, Alabama who were white and who had I would have thought.
I'm surprised at that. Another thing, too, is we must remember is, and I was in Greenville, Mississippi, a few months ago on my book tour, Greenville being probably the most liberal town in the state of Mississippi. In the graduating class of Greenville High School 2005, there was not one single white person.
Wow.
Not one. All the white kids had fled, or their parents had taken them out and put them in private academies, church schools of one sort or another, or private schools. So there's been a great fleeing, and so there has been, again, a kind of a resegregation of schools throughout the South. But that's happened all across the country, too.
Yes, it has.
So there's still a tremendous amount of racism against blacks. And it will always be there. We can only hope that it will get better. And it is getting better. The change is unbelievable. I often say when I'm talking that I did witness things that made me throw up in revulsion. But the larger picture is that I saw about 100 kids and Martin Luther King. 100 kids, mostly black, a few Jewish, literally change this country in a period of about 5 years.
Yeah, that's right.
And they did it without violence, just on the strength of their passion, their commitment to justice.
And their courage.
And their courage.
Yeah.
And they did it nonviolently, and it's just an unbelievably stupendous thing that's happened in our history. And by the way, what these kids did paved the way for the anti-Vietnam War movement, the women's movement.
Oh, yes.
And the gay rights movement, so that as a consequence of what these brave kids did in the 1960s, more people in this country have more rights than ever before in history. And that's a good thing.
I wish
God knows the problem hasn't been solved.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, thank you so much. I appreciate speaking with you.
You're very welcome. Thank you for the call. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest today, Carl Fleming, author of the memoir Son of the Rough South, an Uncivil Memoir. Well, covering this momentous time, 5 years of upheaval, and yet at the same time, the objective was justice. What did that mean to you in your life?
Well, as I say, I had become a real, legitimate, hardcore, tough guy, and Martin Luther King changed my mind about what it meant to be a man and those kids. Because when I saw him and I saw those kids march out of churches and into the face of guns and clubs and water hoses and police dogs and walk into that, knowing that they faced death, injury, imprisonment, I thought to myself, my God, that's what it means really to be a man. And so they really did change my own heart. And by the way, right now I'm launched into a new book about male friendship and my own evolution as a result of that experience in the civil rights movement, in which I have changed from a guy who was your typical, I think, American male, whose friendships with men was based on telling jokes and drinking and talking about sports and banter and never really talking about honest stuff and what's really going on in your life. And I am writing about that and talking about the fact that in my own evolutions, somewhat in the twilight of my life, as my contemporaries and kids I grew up with are now dying, I have now become a man who is able to say to another man, you know what, I love you. That's a big, profound change for me, and that's what I'm writing about now.
What a great place to wrap up. Carl Fleming, thank you very much for talking with us this
afternoon. I really appreciate being with you.
My pleasure to speak with you.
You ask great questions.
Oh, thank you. Carl Fleming has been our guest in this portion of The Afternoon Magazine. His book, Son of the Rough South, an Uncivil Memoir, now available in paperback, published by Public Affairs Books.